Hello, and welcome to Fathoming Water. I'm your host, Melissa Mosey. I hope you enjoyed our last episode with Central Arizona Project President Lisa Atkins and Arizona Department of Water Resources Director Tom Buschatsky. It was great to talk with the both of them, and we learned much about how responsibility over water in Arizona is shared, along with the new strategic vision plan for water sustainability in Arizona. This episode, we will be talking with Dr. Diana Liverman, co-director of the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment. The Institute promotes interdisciplinary research, teaching, and outreach on the environment at the University of Arizona. Her faculty appointment is in her disciplinary home, the School of Geography and Development, which is where I was first acquainted with her. I have been looking forward to this conversation because Diana brings a very global perspective to the Fathoming Water series. This episode introduces many of the concepts we will be hearing about in future episodes. Her main concern is with the fate of the disadvantaged and disempowered in a changing climate, the poor, women, children, and other species. So this interview is where we start to get to explore how water truly touches on everything in life, from women's rights to consumption to even music. We start off with the discussion about one of the most obvious connections, food. In this episode, we start to realize how interconnected our food supplies are globally. Next week, we will have a Thanksgiving special with local farm president Brian Wong so that everyone can have a chance to be truly thankful we have such full tables, considering how risk from weather events on the other side of the globe can affect our access to food and how much we can pay for food. Food security is one of Dr. Liverman's main areas of study, and in this episode, she lays out the basics. Diana Liverman has had the opportunity to meet with many global leaders through her work, and we get the chance to discuss who she has met and why. A week after we recorded this interview, she attended the White House Summit on Climate and Road to Paris, Business and Science Coming Together. The White House convened business leaders from companies across the country to join the American Business Climate Pledge in preparation for the Paris Global Climate Summit, happening in the first weeks of December. Video from this panel of business leaders, academics, and other policy experts can be found on YouTube on the White House channel. A link can also be found on the Fathoming Water page. Besides being co-director of the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment, she teaches a graduate seminar and a core course for the Environmental Studies Bachelor's of Arts. She has maintained an affiliation with Oxford University, where she is a visiting professor of environmental policy and development in the School of Geography and Environment, and a fellow of Linacre College. Over her career, she has taught at Oxford, Penn State, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, as well as having worked at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Her career has focused on the human dimensions of global environmental change, and her main research interests include climate impacts, vulnerability and adaption, and climate policy and mitigation, especially in the developing world. She also works on the political economy and political ecology of environmental management in the Americas. She has a particular interest in the political ecology of environmental management in the Americas, especially in Mexico. We will discuss what political ecology means, how vulnerability to water shortages is not shared equally, and how climate change will impact all the discussions about water in the future. She has led a number of national and international committees, including the Transition Committee for Future Earth, the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission Committee on the Human Dimensions of Global Environmental Change, the USNRC Panel on Informing America's Climate Choices, and the International Council for Science's Global Environmental Change and Food Systems Project. In short, Diana Liverman has made many contributions to comprehending human dimensions of global environmental change, and I am grateful to have her on Fathoming Water. And now, Diana Liverman. Today I'm sitting with Diana Liverman, the head of the Institute of the Environment at the University of Arizona, and I wanted to ask you first, why does it matter that the general citizenry learn about water and environment and all the things that are associated with that?
Well, the environment is what we live in, and almost all of our basic needs, whether they're water, food, energy, and health, are determined by our environment and the things that we do to it. So if we don't look after our environment, we're going to be in trouble in the future. And most people care about their children and grandchildren or future generations. And because of some of the trends in environmental damage on the planet, we need to care about it, not just for ourselves, but for future generations. And we also need to care about it for other parts of the world, because we're in a globally connected world, whether it's conflict or trade or migration. We need to be concerned about poor people in other parts of the world and how they're being affected by the environment. And we need to care not just in terms of awareness, but in terms of what we do, in terms of what we who we vote for, in terms of the sort of careers that we choose.
It's absolutely true that we are interconnected. You have a very global and international experience. You were born in Ghana to English parents who were working there. Do you want to speak to what you really took with you?
Well, I was always worried about other parts of the world. And my first concern really came out of being born in West Africa, which is during my childhood, there were terrible famines in the Sahel. And because I had been born there, I was really worried. I felt bad that other kids. And, you know, I had a grandmother who, like many grandmothers say, eat up what's on your plate because of children in other parts of the world. But I became fascinated by the relationship between people and environment in other parts of the world. Actually, it started with interest in wildlife. But I then got particularly interested in how we might reduce suffering from natural disasters when I was an undergraduate. And that's actually what led me into working on climate issues, was that drought, floods, you know, they've always affected humanity. But now with what we're doing to the climate, it's likely that we're going to see more extremes and particularly deeper droughts and, you know, fiercer floods. And so I sort of moved from natural disasters as they were to natural disasters and climate change and what might happen, particularly to the poorest of the poor.
Would you define this body of work as political ecology?
You can define it as political ecology, though that's often viewed as an academic term. I mean, for me, being a political ecologist means paying attention to nature, to the sort of physical environment itself. We can't ignore that. But it also means looking at political economy, about the institutions, the structures, the markets that are forcing us to degrade the environment or maybe helping us heal the environment. But it's not as if everything's determined by nature and political economy. We've also got the ability to act. So political ecology combines that sort of structural and environmental constraints on what we can do with our own ability and choices. So that's why I call myself a political ecologist, though more simply, I would just say I'm somebody who's interested in human-environment relations. And I'm, although I've got training in physical science, I really work much more in social science now, trying to understand both the way in which human activity is driving changes in the environment and the ways in which humans are affected, and then the policies that they develop, which is why I also call what I do the human dimensions of global environmental change.
We're eventually going to have people like Paul Robbins on, and so I wanted to introduce the idea, the concept of political ecology out there. So I think it's a great definition.
Well, I think Paul will tell you when, in terms of the way he thinks about political ecology, is it is also linked to action. So many, and my colleague Tracy Osborne at University of Arizona runs the Public Political Ecology Lab. And that's how we take this more academic understanding and take it out and work with NGOs and work with policymakers. And that's certainly something I've always tried to do.
How are climate and water linked?
Well, they're incredibly tightly linked. I mean, the amount of water that we have on the Earth is linked to the climate that we've had over millennia, because the amount of water that's available for us to consume is determined by precipitation. But it's not only by precipitation, that's rainfall or snow. It's also by evaporation. So that we know very well in Tucson, a hot day, water disappears much faster than a cold day. So in order to really understand water supply, we've got to understand both how much it's raining, but also how hot it is and how quickly it'd be evaporated. And that's sort of the physical side of the hydrological cycle. And we know that it's going to rain more where there are mountains and in certain parts of the planet. But of course, the other part of the equation is demand. And it's that balance between the supply and demand for water. But also, you've also got to add quality, because you can have lots of water, but if it's all salty, it's not going to be useful for drinking water.
In terms of climate change, we see a shifting of the jet stream, the major mover mm-hmm. of weather across our planet. And what does this mean?
If the jet stream does shift, then it's going to change storm tracks. That's the main issue. But it may also mean we get a more loopy jet stream where it goes further north and comes further south, so we can get warmer weather further north and colder weather further south. So it brings a lot of variability. But in terms of climate change, I mean, the most important impacts on our water resources are going to be changes in the pattern of rainfall. And to be honest, the climate scientists still don't have a good sense of that, though we do see hot spots, and the Southwest US is one where almost all the climate models think it is going to get drier. But the temperature effect is really important, and we know that it's warming. It's already warming. We're likely to warm 4 degrees centigrade, 7 degrees Fahrenheit if we don't do something about climate change. And that is just going to evaporate a whole lot more water. So if we look at the future of the Colorado, the sort of stuff that my colleague Jonathan Overpeck's working on, it's as much the fact that the temperature is going to warm up and the snow is going to melt sooner and it's going to evaporate that means that we'll have less water in the Southwest. It's as much that temperature effect as it is rainfall. And then, of course, you add to that all of the increasing demand. So when we've got less water in some parts of the world and more people demanding that water, that's when we start to get into serious problems.
Now, in comparison of the U.S. and in particular the Southwest U.S., to other parts of the globe, how severe is the Southwest situation in the U.S. compared to, let's say, places like Bangladesh?
Yeah. Well, in terms of water supplies, we're a semi-arid region, so our supply is limited. We've got more and more people moving in here. What people have here more than they do in Bangladesh is money. So I always say to people, if things got really bad in the Southwest, those who are well off would buy water from the farmers, because agriculture is using a lot of the water, as is in most parts of the world. And we could also probably buy desalination plants. But in poorer parts of the world, people can't afford to buy water on a water market. They can't afford to desal. So that's where this idea of vulnerability comes in. Vulnerability, you know, is about how much money you have, about how much flexibility you have, about how much access to government help you have. So when there's a drought in many parts of the world, people just can't get the help. Whereas, you know, if you take the California drought, there are all sorts of policy measures. I mean, although it's affecting farmers, it's not like they're living really on the line of losing their lives. They might have their livelihoods affected. So it does vary a lot around the world. And there are, in fact, some parts of the world that might get a little bit wetter, which could help people. But then you have other problems, because then you've got more disease, for example, like mosquitoes.
Would infrastructure also be part of this conversation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's part of the big debate overall for the planet, is that there's increasingly a group of people who are arguing for geoengineering the planet, which is doing really major things like putting sulfur particles up into the air or doing things to the ocean to try to influence what's happening to the climate. So there's these big technology solutions, but there's also smaller technology solutions. So in lots of parts of the world, people are thinking we'll build more dams, or maybe we could use water more efficiently, or we could switch to different crops. So the range of technology options is large, but some of them are very expensive and some of them are very unpredictable, which is why a lot of people are worried about geoengineering the planet to bring the temperature down.
In terms of food and its relation to water, mm-hmm. obviously food is grown using water. It could be groundwater. It could be a reliance on surface water. How is food insecurity related to water insecurity?
Well, the first thing I would say is that our food security in the Southwest is vulnerable to what happens in the rest of the world. Our food's not grown here for the most part. Our food is imported from Mexico, from Australia. And there's sort of a little bit of a misconception that if we understood what was happening to the climate in a particular place, it would tell us what would happen to food. But we're in a globalized food system. Most food is being traded. So the places we really need to be worried about in a global sense are the breadbaskets of the world. So Australia, Russia and Central Europe, the U.S. Midwest. I mean, that's where we could start to see crop failures and serious problems that would affect basic grains. And for rice, we need to be worried about what would happen to the monsoon in Asia. So that's the first thing, is we're in a very, very connected world. And there are certain things. I mean, one of the things people are always horrified by, though it's sort of slightly a luxurious horror to have, is that there's definitely suggestions that coffee, for example, and chocolate are extremely vulnerable to climate change. So we might have to pay a lot more for coffee or chocolate or wine. And they're clearly luxury items, but people don't want to pay more for those. And the changing climate and water availability is going to affect it. Now, water is more important, obviously, in the semi-arid regions of the world, because there's a lot of crops that are grown just by the rain, in fact, in a lot of the Midwest. But if we look at California or parts of Mexico or parts of Australia, it's all irrigated agriculture. And irrigated agriculture uses enormous amounts of water. So there's a lot of things we need to think through in terms of how much of the world we devote to irrigation. And also, as water becomes scarce, are we going to take water away from agriculture for urban or for ecosystem needs?
Let's turn to other places in the world that are using irrigated agriculture. Australia, for instance, just came out of a decade and a half drought. About
a very serious drought.
It was extremely serious. And I mean, they did something very different. They really engaged their citizenry in discussing water and created new tools and new policies for water use.
Yeah. But there are limits. I mean, you can do that. And of course, the University of Arizona, one of our really big areas of expertise is climate change adaptation. We have a center. We have actually had the Australians coming to visit us to talk about what they're doing. But so you can do a lot to adapt. You can get people to use less water. But getting individuals to use less water, it's really a drop in the bucket, so to speak. You've got to really look at what the major users of water are. And it is often agriculture. But what's happening in Australia is that agriculture is actually shifting because the climate zones are shifting. So the wine area in Australia, the wine growers are now actually buying land in other areas where either they've got more access to water or they might move further south into Tasmania where there's more water because the areas that they're in are drying up. And we're already seeing that in the US, is shifts in crop zones. And of course, the problem there is, somebody like Gary Nabhan would say, is that there's a disconnect then between agriculture and culture, because in many parts of the world, culture has shaped itself around growing wine or growing chilies. But if the climate zones of the world all move poleward, that breaks that important connection.
I hadn't even thought about the cultural aspects of it, but it's true, our culture is completely based on things like food and art.
And the other part of that is, as if we get much more concerned about food security, there's the push to grow higher yielding varieties, and they sort of push out the traditional crops as well. And, you know, when you're trying to feed 9 billion people, people are going to get really concerned about getting the very highest yields out of a particular area of land.
Things are changing in terms of population, in the fact that people are having less children now.
Well, if we look at the overall driving forces for environmental impact, there's a very famous equation called the IPAT equation, which is that environmental impact is population numbers multiplied by per capita consumption, multiplied by the sort of technology they use. And you can change any one of those to reduce or increase environmental impact. So for many years, sort of popular intellectuals like Paul Ehrlich and others would say, it's population growth. We've got to reduce birth rates because that's you know, screwing the planet up. But what's happened now is that for a whole bunch of other reasons, not for the environment, mostly to do with status of women, is that the fertility rate, the number of children each woman will have, has fallen dramatically. It's the most dramatic change in potential environmental impact in my lifetime. Because what's happened is that in a lot of parts of the world, women have chosen, and they have access to contraception, but they've also made choices around, because they're better educated, they want to have a career. They've gone from having 6 children to 4 children to 2 children. We can see that in Mexico, where the fertility rate is coming down towards 2, which is replacement fertility. And what they're showing now is, we used to think the population would grow exponentially, that it would just keep growing and growing and growing. But now, under some scenarios, so long as we maintain the status of women around the world, we will probably see the population leveling off in this century. And, you know, maybe around 9, maybe around 10 billion. That's still too many people probably for the planet. But it's almost as though the women of the world have got it sorted out. If we just maintain their status, that's okay. What we need to focus on is consumption per capita, because that is the thing that's out of control in most parts of the world. And so I will say to people, don't worry about so much about population. If we keep these choice trends going, let's focus on how much people are consuming. And in all parts of the world, particularly as people come out of poverty, we want people to come out of poverty around the world. And we've halved poverty globally in the last 25 years, which is pretty amazing. But the irony is, as people come out of poverty, they buy more stuff. And that means that their per capita consumption increases of water, of food, of all of the different resources.
And increase in carbon, too, as well.
Yeah, China and greenhouse gases. So while population rate, growth rates are dropping around the world, CO2 emissions, greenhouse gas emissions are still going up.
So water is also a women's issue as well. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that water is able to touch on pretty much any issue in the world. There's a lot going on there in just terms of security of water in the home, especially in places like Africa.
And women often have to collect all the water and do all the work. And it's women who benefit most when we give people access to drinking water and access to sanitation. And that's actually also where we've had a fair amount of success. I mean, just the other week, the UN met and they looked at the Millennium Development Goals, which were a set of goals over reducing poverty over the last 25 years. And progress on water was actually pretty amazing. We had halved the number of people without access to safe drinking water, and we've almost halved the number of people without sanitation. And that is, you know, millions and millions of people now have access to water, and it's benefited women a lot. But I think the big challenge now looking forward is, how do we maintain those successes in the face of climate change? And how do we actually get to a point where everybody has safe water? And there is now a goal. There's a new set of goals that have just been established called the Sustainable Development Goals. And the goal there is safe drinking water for everybody.
Oh, that would be awesome.
It would be.
That would be fantastic.
But we did a lot in the last 25 years. So it shows, it often seems as though everything that we're talking about is so negative and all going in the wrong direction. But if you take access to water and population fertility rates, those are two pieces that are sort of good news for the planet. And they're good news for women, too, because women are choosing not to have as many children. And when they've got safe drinking water, they don't have to, like, go out into dangerous areas or spend their whole time collecting water.
That's true. War-torn areas often make it extremely difficult for vulnerable people to get the resources they need and the food they need, as well as water. Per capita consumptive use is our biggest issue, would you say, moving forward?
On water.
On water, yes.
Yeah. Consumptive use, which means you've used the water and you're not reusing it and someone else isn't reusing it. So we can still use as much water if we figure out how to recycle most of it.
Ah, that's a great point. Hmm. So reclamation of water, using effluent. Tucson has been really at the forefront of using the Purple Pipe, where we use our effluent to water golf courses, parks, etc. And obviously this has great possibilities throughout the world as
Except
well.
Except my colleague Shane Snyder, who's in engineering here and is an expert on water reuse, he would, I think, argue that we shouldn't have separate water systems. all water should be recycled and should just go back into the system because it's so expensive to build a dual pipe system. So, and it's partly because of public attitudes that we have the pipe system because people don't want to drink their own pee. But the most efficient thing to do would be to have very high quality water treatment so that the water just goes back into the system that we have.
What are the best steps that a person living in Tucson or a person living in New York City can make to help better the world?
That's a really interesting question, and I'm going to answer it from like an academic point of view.
That's fine.
Which is individual behavior can only go so far in reducing environmental impact. So, you know, we can put in a low flow showerhead, a low flow toilet. We can have rainwater harvesting. We can stop flying. We can ride our bike, but that's maybe going to help like 15 or 20% of the problem we're responsible for. Part of the problem is we don't have the choices available to make the individual behavioral changes. I mean, we're starting to get all electric cars, but the poor can't afford them, and they're not yet fully, the electricity isn't generated by solar. So we need corporations to provide us with an awful lot of choices, and we need politicians to not get in the way of sustainability and to subsidize more sustainable alternatives. So I would say there's, although you can do a lot in terms of your own environmental footprint, the biggest changes you can make are through your consumption so that you're buying, and we know this is not a political point, we know this from research, that putting pressure on certain companies to give you sustainable alternatives or voting for politicians who will push us towards sustainable alternatives will probably have a bigger impact than your own behavior.
So the power of the purse has an incredible impact.
On or of your vote.
Or your vote.
Yeah.
You have met with an incredible group of people over the years. Would you like to speak to some of the people that you have been working with and what they're doing to improve the condition of the world?
Well, I have been really lucky to meet some really amazing people. I mean, a few years ago, I was asked to be part of a group that provided a personal seminar to the Dalai Lama on climate change. And that was an incredible privilege to spend a week with him. He's very interested in science. He's very concerned about climate change because of the impact in Tibet, but also more globally. But I've also had the opportunity to represent the research community at international conferences where I've been able to meet, you know, leaders from around the world. There are people who've really inspired me. The other person, she was actually in Tucson last year, is Mary Robinson, who's the former president of Ireland. And she and UN Commission on Human Rights, and her issue now is climate justice and women and climate. And she's completely inspirational. I find most politicians I'm a bit cynical about, but she was pretty amazing. And the other group that I'm working with right now, which is really interesting, is I sit on the board of an NGO in the UK that is trying to bring down greenhouse gas emissions in the cultural sector and in music and art. And we're putting together right now a consortium of pretty well-known cultural icons to write a letter for the Paris climate negotiations. So I was just laughing to myself last week because I was in this email exchange with people like David Bowie and Robert Plant, who all really care about climate. And that's a completely different experience from working with world leaders or religious leaders, is actually working. And of course, they're not the people who are going to change youth. We need to access some of the more the popular singers for younger people. But, you know, I think the humanities, the writers and the musicians have the power to change attitudes, perhaps more than the scientists do, which is why I'm working with those groups.
And it once again draws together the fact that we really are on this little spaceship flying out through space, and we call it Earth, and how it all is
space oddity, David Bowie would say.
Yes, space. And the touch, you know, the fact that arts and humanities can provide such an incredible impact on things like our water use, on things like the way governments work, that just shows this interconnection between
yeah.
it all.
I hope they can. I mean, it's sort of sometimes I might think of it as desperation that I'm trying to find all these other groups to work with because the scientists don't seem to have changed hearts and minds. I hope that the cultural sector, I hope that the business sector, as businesses become more aware, that they really can change things. But at the moment, it's more of a hope. I don't know that it's going to work.
Well, I think, you know, growing up with you two, and yeah. Bono was very much pushing for all sorts of environmental and social yeah. justice. And growing up listening to that music made me more aware and made me more want to pursue a career where I'm looking at bettering yeah. the world.
He actually is a good example of someone who's changed things, less on the environment, but I give him and others, including a number of the African musicians, a lot of credit when in 2000 we cancelled third world debt, you know, a lot of third world debt. The sort of Make Poverty History campaign was incredibly successful. I mean, maybe governments were going to change anyway, but that sort of pressure or some of the organizations around sort of famine and food, yeah, we have seen successes. But as a researcher, I sort of want to go out and find out whether, in fact, it has made a difference. So if you add up all the... Well, one of the things we found out in the research we did on music and the environment is everybody assumed that it was U2 flying around in their big jet that was the environmental impact. That's tiny compared to the impact of audience travel. It's all those people driving to gigs. Oh. That are emitting. So then we've been working with some in the UK, we've been working with some of the festival organizers to try to figure out how they can persuade people to car share or go by bus, because that is the biggest part of the carbon footprint of the music industry is the audience, and it's the hardest one to change.
Yeah. Now, what about donations? Is that a way that people can have an impact?
Yes, of course you can make a difference by volunteering or donating, but you know, they've got different roles. So you've got the campaigning organizations like Greenpeace or 350.org who are trying to influence politicians and businesses. So there's that route, but there's also the humanitarian organizations like Oxfam. And I think I've done a little bit of work with Oxfam, and I think they're a very good organization. But in that case, you want to make sure that they're not, if it's like after a disaster, a big hurricane or a flood, you want to make sure it's an organization that isn't just helping people only in crisis, that it's an organization that invests in resilience and reducing vulnerability, so that they're not just going in when it's bad. They're trying to make sure that the next time it's not so big a problem. And the Red Cross does that. Some of the work we've done in the Caribbean with the Red Cross is about reducing vulnerability so that the disaster won't be so great next time. So I do think that some of these organizations make a big difference. And I think that the environmental organizations have kept up the pressure on climate change. I don't agree with all of their strategies, but they're very different. And you need to sort of look at the organization and see what solutions they're proposing and decide if it's in line with your own beliefs. But you can do a lot volunteering as well. If you don't have a lot of money, you can be a volunteer.
Where are you headed next?
This time next week, I'll be in the White House. They're holding a climate summit. I'm sure there'll be tons of people there. But I had like, shall I fly to Washington? And I thought, no, this is important because even though the current administration has tried to do a lot on climate, there's a lot more we need to do. So they're bringing together scientists and business people and NGOs for a summit. But the reason that we're having that discussion next week is because in December is the international climate negotiations, where every year we get together with the world and we try to do something about climate. And we tried, the last big one was in 2009, where we didn't make the commitments we needed to do. And although we've been meeting every year, Paris is considered the big chance to sort of save the planet. And so lots of people will be going to Paris. There's a small delegation from Tucson going, including artists, including student activists. And what we really want to do is to get the countries of the world to agree to reduce emissions and to put together enough money to help the poorest of the poor adapt to climate change. And I hope we make some progress, because at this point, if we don't, we're heading for a much warmer world than we ever thought, and we're heading for a lot of suffering for the poor. And we know that the U.S. can't do it on its own. But what's interesting is in the last few months, China's made serious commitments to reduce emissions. India has made serious commitments. So some of the biggest players are starting to take it seriously. What I'm worried about is that the commitments they've made either aren't big enough or won't be followed through on. And I'm a bit worried that Paris is going to end up with a voluntary agreement that sounds good, but nothing that is sort of binding on anybody actually following through on their commitments.
Well, we will hope that that is not the case. And is water in these conversations?
Oh, absolutely. Water is there as we talk about the potential impacts of climate change, but water is also there in terms of what we need to do. So obviously, adapting to climate change, we need water. We've got to rethink water for the most vulnerable. And there's even something called blue carbon, which is about how we might be able to take greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere and sequester them in lakes and marshes and even in the ocean, so that water becomes and water management becomes part of the solution to climate change, as well as sort of an area that's impacted.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your insight into this insight on this podcast, as these issues are so big and there's so many different issues, and this is our chance to kind of realize how large in scope that this conversation can go. And thank you for all your great work that you're doing out there.
And make sure KXCI plays those musicians who are committing to solving climate change.
Oh, I think we already do. But
Katie Tunstall's a big one as well.
She gets a lot of play around here, yes.
Good.
Yes.
Okay, keep playing Katie. She's good on it.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Diana Liverman, and good luck in D.C. and in Paris.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much to Dr. Diana Liverman. To learn more about Diana, you can visit dianaliverman.wordpress.com. More information on the White House Summit on Climate and the Road to Paris, Business and Science Coming Together, can be found on YouTube on the White House channel. A link can also be found on the Fathoming Water page. We wish her the best of luck in helping to achieve concrete goals at the Paris Global Climate Summit, happening in the first weeks of December. Very sad and horrific events have happened in Paris since Diana and I spoke, and our hearts here at KXCI and Fathoming Water go out to all those affected by these events. Unfortunately, these events can be linked back to water insecurity and drought in Syria, and in future episodes, I hope to unravel how insecurity in the fundamentals of living, such as food and water insecurity, shape fundamentalist thinking that underpins the nature of war and violence. I am very grateful to Dr. Liverman for opening that conversation today, which starts to tackle these less obvious connections around water. In next week's episode, we speak with president of BKW Farms, Brian Wong. Fathoming Water is releasing it as its Thanksgiving special because as we sit down with family and friends around tables full of food, it is a perfect time to reflect on exactly how that food gets to your table. Brian is a third-generation farmer and now president of BKW Farms in Marana, Arizona. He graduated from the University of Arizona in 2011 with a major in agricultural economics and management. Brian sits as chairperson on the Citizens Water Advisory Committee. He is a board member with the Southern Arizona Water Users Association as well. He participated in the Sustainable Water for Southern Arizona Current Conditions and Future Prospects Community Forum, where he represented BKW Farms and the agricultural perspective. So on your Thanksgiving weekend, take some time to listen to Fathoming Water. Thank you so much to Dr. Diana Liverman for this episode's interview. Thank you so much to Chris Levesque for our theme music, A Walk in the Wasteland. I'm your host, Melissa Mosey, and thank you for listening.